Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Before we start, if you guys could just help us out in podcast land a little bit, we are running a survey. It is at voxmedia.com/podsurvey. Getting input from you about what we're doing here is really important to the future. So voxmedia.com/podsurvey. Lyman Stone is one of the most interesting characters I know on the internet, and it was great. He was in town. I was able to sit down and talk to him about babies, basically, and what we know about how policy can impact families' fertility decisions. It's really interesting stuff. I think you are going to learn a lot. This is not something we talk about a lot in liberal circles, but it's really important. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. I'm here today with Lyman Stone. He is a senior fellow at the Institute of Family Studies, an adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a great Twitter personality, writer, thinker. And we are here to talk about babies.
My favorite topic.
Sure. So the birth rate has fallen record low. I find most people, when they see that, they just assume, well, if people are having fewer kids, American people, it's because they want fewer kids than they had in the past.
Yeah, this is usually when you say, well, birth rates have gone down, and people say, well, isn't that a good thing? Because that just means, you know, that people are having the kids they want less, and who can judge that? But practically speaking, this isn't true. We have a very large number of surveys that ask men, women, everybody, how many kids do you want to have? How many kids do you desire to have? How many kids is ideal to have? We have lots of ways of asking this question, but they always come back pretty much the same thing. People want somewhere between 2.1 and 2.6 kids on average. Right now, they're likely to have about 1.7. So this is not about people wanting fewer kids.
Right. So the first time I read this, I was like, this is a little dumb, but maybe worth just explaining to everyone. It's not like anyone is saying, I want 2.6 kids, right? So it's like the general social survey, it asks people, like, what's the ideal size of family? Some people say zero kids, not that many. Larger number of people say one. Some say two. Some say three.
Some say like 12.
Right.
And you think, really?
But so you statistically average it out, right?
Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
Like a typical person wants two or three children, more or less.
Exactly.
Right?
And, you know, there are some weird answers, right? So you get the person who says they want 37 children, and you think, well, how do I average that? And then you also get the person who says, well, as many as you want to have.
Sure.
You say, well, that's what I'm trying to ask you. So you do have to have a little bit of like creativity, like how do you account for unrealistic outlier responses, and how do you account for what we call non-numeric responses to these questions? But there's a huge like methodological literature on this, and it really doesn't matter how you count it. It doesn't matter how you phrase the question. I mean, it does matter. It changes a bit, but there's no way to cut the data. There's no way to phrase the question and get an outcome below two kids per woman.
Right. And so you would expect, you know, some people want to have kids, want to have more kids, but they have fertility problems.
Sure.
And so they don't. On the flip side, some people may have two or three kids and be done, but there's an accident. people are, there are people who don't have abortions. So you expect some errors on both sides, but we fall consistently about one baby per woman below for a number of years now.
Right now, on average, we're at about 1.7 right now, expected lifetime fertility, and the desired rate is around 2.3. So we're about 0.6 kids below. So I hate saying like 0.6 kids because there's not really a 0.6 child. So I think you can think of this as for every 10 women in America, there would be 6 missing children, right? Which to me sounds pretty significant. But this is much larger than it's been in the past. From 1990 to 2007, I was about 2 missing kids for every 10 women. So this is a pretty recent thing, really since 2007, that this gap has really exploded.
And it's interesting because it's a subtle difference, right? Like, as you say, like it comes down to 0.6 kids, which is a weird thing to talk about. But it's not the difference between like everybody has the kinds of families we have today versus everyone has like giant Hutterite families. It's like the occasional second or third or fourth child sprinkled here and there among what we would still be recognizably modern post-demographic transition households.
Absolutely. We're not talking about a difference between modernity and traditionalism or between the Amish or something. We're talking about people in, you know, 1 to 3 child families, and there just happen to be more people now who wanted that third and just aren't getting it. Life didn't work out for them that way. It's just... you could say it's just sort of one of those disappointments of life that's in the background of people's thinking somewhere.
And so what do we know about why this is?
Most research on this question doesn't look at the fertility gap per se. It looks at just birth rates in general. Now, luckily, desired fertility is highly stable. So these are basically the same thing. So what we know is that the main reason fertility has declined in America, and by fertility, I just mean actual birth rates, not biological fertility, is changes in marriage behavior. That is, once you account for marital status, just pure change in composition by age of married people, it turns out that fertility today is almost exactly what it was in 2000.
Okay.
Now, it's lower than it was about 10 years ago because it kind of rose after 2000. But it's most of the change we can see is basically just a change in who's married.
Okay. So what does that mean? A change, like people are married older?
People are married older. They're less likely to be married at any given age.
Okay.
Now, once you get to like age 45, the odds of being married are pretty much the same. Also, once you get to age 45, the odds of having an additional child are fairly low. So among ages where biological ability to conceive a child are highest, marriage rates have consistently fallen for the last 60 years.
And then birth rate. So it's like people want to, obviously not all people, but many people would like to get married, would like to have children, would like to get married and then have children. Traditional bourgeois life script. But
the success sequence. This is what many people intuitively think their life will be or should be.
And I mean, what's interesting is in many cases, in fact, is.
Yeah, of
just
course.
Just sort of 5 to 10 years later than it might have been in the 70s.
Right. This is exactly what it is, that we actually see people in some sense following this sort of life script more consistently than in the past, that, you know, divorce rates have fallen, pregnancy rates out of wedlock are actually going down. And we see teen childbearing in particular has plummeted, which is, you know, I think we're all cheering for that one. So we see that really people are avoiding sort of the big deviations from this life script more than in the past. But by at the same time that they're avoiding those, what they might perceive as errors in how they planned they hoped their life might be, it's just taking longer to get the things that they do want.
Right. And I mean, this is like if anyone out there listening, like if you were around for like 1990s politics, there was like a big social concern about essentially like, I guess you would call them like deviant behaviors. Sure. That like people were either there were teenagers who were having kids, there were unmarried people who were having kids, and there was a lot of of social concern. This was right. being linked, I think, in some intuitive ways to child poverty and in some slightly loopy ways to, like, really big cultural anxieties. And we have done a good job of sort of turning the ship around on that. And, I mean, it's interesting when it comes to marriage because, of course, I think people want to be responsible with sure. their lives, right? They don't mm-hmm. want to just, like, get married at 16 right. and then get divorced at 25. Right. So they are going to college.
Yeah, and these are all reasonable things.
Graduating.
The problem is that marriage, you know, well, if you look at the opioid epidemic, mm-hmm. your odds of dying of an opioid overdose are rather different if you're married than if you're single. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about these sort of middle-aged white males, mm-hmm. but the demographic that's, if you look beneath that, this is basically unmarried. Hmm. What we're talking about is unmarried people.
Okay.
The delayed marriage, you look at increased episodes of depression, mm-hmm. this is almost entirely explained by unmarried people.
Hmm.
That a lot of what we're seeing with these sort of objectively observed things that many of us think are not great in society, increases in suicidal ideation, increases in depression, increases in attempted suicide, increases in deaths of despair. They have many, many, many different sources, but they also seem to track with changes in people's odds of being married. Now, we don't want to rush people into marriages that are going to end in a divorce 6 years later and perhaps with a child who now grows up in, you know, a home that's at greater risk of housing instability and poverty and these sorts of things. Like, we don't want to encourage people to make life choices they themselves regard as irresponsible. But I think we also want to figure out, is there a way that we can accelerate people's ability to achieve the life goals that they themselves desire and regard as responsible.
Right. And you see, I mean, I think the point about the opioids and the suicide and things like that sure. is that marriage is an emotional resource for yeah. people. I mean, among other things.
It's a material, emotional resource. Also, there's someone in your life who, when you start down that path, they go, hey, this is not good.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's somebody watching your back,
right.
Helping you out, but also maybe yelling at you.
Sure.
If that's what you need. But one of the things that's happened, right, is the economy is different mm-hmm. from how it used to be.
Exactly.
And
it's human capital driven.
Right. So you're told that if you want, like, a good job and to make a good living, you should go to college,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people do.
Yep. I did. I believe you did.
I did. Most people I know did. And that just, like, that takes 4 years of your life,
mm-hmm.
right? And then
there's grad school, right? Because
for some people,
you know,
yeah.
to get that, you know, climbing white collar job, there's grad school or law school or medical school or whatever. Yeah.
Or even, you know, like in journalism, right? I didn't do any kind of grad school, but you do a. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't even formally call it an apprenticeship, but it's like it's
exactly,
understood
yeah.
that if you want a career in journalism, yep. you have to work for several years mm-hmm. in extremely low-paying jobs, and a lot of the people who do that won't make it, and you'll shift careers.
And it's difficult to marry and form stable life during that time of your life.
Right, because yeah. you don't have much money,
mm-hmm.
but also, like, if whether you're a grad student or you're just in some kind of entry-level position, if you know that you need to keep your sort of options open in life, mm-hmm. right, like you might need to yep. move to a different city. Then
why put down roots?
Right. Well, and you don't want to tie yourself yeah. down.
So this story really makes a lot of sense. The only problem with it is that empirically, white-collar people are getting married at the same rates they always were.
Huh.
And actually, at similar ages.
Interesting.
The big change is among working class people. The big decline in marriage is not, frankly, it's not folks like you and me.
Okay.
It's people with less degrees and less income. And so my intuition is always like, oh, yeah, it takes a long time to do college and graduate school, and everybody uh-huh. does that, right? Well, no, like 70% of Americans don't do that.
Right.
So, okay, so then those are the people that are having this decline in marriage. So what is it? Well, there is still an extended entree into your kind of peak earning. We do see that even less educated Americans, their peak earnings come later in life than in the past. It takes longer to kind of fully enter the workforce. So there is still something going on there with skills acquisition and training. But another thing which which is near and dear to my heart, is actually the vast array of special penalties and taxes that we put on working class marriage.
How do you mean?
Well, let's say you get the earned income tax credit.
Okay.
It's great as long as you're not married.
Ah.
But if you get married, you lose thousands of dollars of benefits. Hmm. Let's say you get married to the parent of children in your house.
Mm-hmm.
The earned income tax credit says you all should not get married. You should not live together.
Hmm.
Right? Same thing with housing vouchers. Same thing with SNAP. Same thing with Medicaid. Same thing with Obamacare premium supplements. These programs are fine. Like, they don't hurt. It doesn't hurt marriage to pay for a kid's food, but it does alter people's odds of getting married to pay for food on the condition that they not get married.
Right. And so this is, I mean, again, a classic like 90s policy debate was about marriage penalties in the income tax code.
And a lot of them were done away with.
Right. And that's
but
been
not
largely
the EITC.
And it's, right. And, but so the like middle class sort
we
of
did away with middle has, class tax
has yep. largely gone away, but yep. the means tested
has gotten bigger
programs. Because there's more of them.
There's
right?
more of them. And EITC has been expanded several times. And I'm a big, as an economist, I'm a big fan of the EITC. It's a good way to deliver benefits to people to, you know, help them make ends meet for honest work. But, you know, maybe we should have thought about what it would do to give people $4,000 or $5,000 not to be married.
Right. And so this is essentially the penalty arises because of how the means test is
right. It's,
is applied.
It's the eligibility rules. It's not the program itself.
Right.
And in fact, you actually see this comparatively with other countries, especially if you compare various Anglophone countries, which, you know, we like to compare because various similar cultural sure. and immigration backgrounds. The countries that more explicitly penalized marriage
mm-hmm.
By yanking benefits when you get married, in fact, had greater increases in particularly non-marital childbearing from the 1960s to the present day. So the UK explicitly had extra child benefits for unmarried parents.
Okay.
I mean, it makes sense on the basis of need that you might say, well, there's not, well, if you're a 1950 Brit, you might say, well, there's not a man in the house. And so
sure.
they need extra help.
Right.
Well, that isn't exactly the world we live in anymore. So it took until the 90s for them to phase out this sort of extra benefit for these, you know, I guess, women that they just, as a matter of law, regarded as helpless.
Right.
So the UK had a much greater increase in non-marital childbearing than we did. And you sort of put all the countries together and you see this fairly clear that a significant amount of the rise in non-marital childbearing, and which is largely about a decline in marriage, can be accounted for by the presence or absence of marriage penalties. Not welfare programs generally,
mm-hmm.
but marriage penalties in welfare programs.
And so if you're at least a progressive-minded person, you could eliminate these by essentially making the program more generous,
sure.
right? I guess you'd have to, you know, get into the numbers.
Sure. It costs about $400 billion a year. I did the math on fixing like EITC, Section 8, SNAP, Medicaid, like all these different programs. What does it cost? I did the math kind of back of the envelope-ish, but minimum you're talking like $200 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
You can run up to like $600 or $700.
Right.
which is to say that we're really imposing a difficulty on these families that is like a $500 billion thumb on the scales against working class people marrying each other.
Right. Well, I mean, it helps explain that the scale of the effect is that there's a lot of money involved, right?
It does.
And this is, of course, we're going to go on to talk about this, but this is sort of the disconnect in American politics is that the kinds of people most likely to be concerned about these things are also the kinds of people least likely to be interested in like spending large sums of money.
That has historically been the case. It is, as you know, it is definitely my political mission to nudge that needle a bit,
mm-hmm.
To encourage, let's call it a new fusionism between a more generous family policy and, for me personally, a more conservative outlook on society. But yeah, you're right that historically, the people who've been talking a lot about the importance of, you know, stable families and households and marriage were not the folks saying, yeah, let's spend some more money on Section 8 housing vouchers.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a break and then I want to talk about some big ideas.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media. Pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context. And it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So my recollection is that a bunch of countries have from time to time sort of tried programs that like pay people money to, I don't know, pay people money to have babies, but there's money and there's babies involved. My sort of like hazy recollection of this is that the results have been pretty disappointing. Is that right?
So a lot of countries have implemented what we would call pronatalist policies, policies that are explicitly aimed to encourage births. Mm-hmm. And generally what we find is that when new pronatal benefits are put in place, mm-hmm. birth rates do rise. Mm-hmm. By a little bit, mm-hmm. that it takes a lot of money. Estimates for a marginal additional child, mm-hmm. A child who otherwise would not have been born in some counterfactual, estimates range at cost between $100,000 and $1 million, mm-hmm. which is a fairly large amount of money to get one kid. Now, what's really happening is you're spending $2,000 on every child, and one in every 50 families or 60 families says, "Oh, okay, we can now afford to have one more child." But the cost per marginal child is relatively high.
Right. So this is, in case people miss this, right? It's because without even absent such a policy, lots of people have children anyway. So when you create the new pronatalist policy, a lot of the money winds up going to
children who would have been born anyway.
Right. Yeah. Right. So it winds up making the marginal child look incredibly expensive.
Now, I should know, I always thought that this was really expensive. And then I was speaking to someone who studies late in life health programs, Medicare, right. Medicaid. The cost to save a year of life, mm-hmm. One quality adjusted life year in Medicare or Medicaid is between like $40,000 and $90,000.
Right.
So what we're really saying here is you can, it costs about as much to get one extra human being who will live probably at least 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. 70, 80, 90 years, as extending a retiree's life by 1 to 10 years.
Right. So, okay. So in quality adjusted life years terms,
it's a cheap way to get life years.
Paying for babies is more if you're a sort of.
But preventing death, of course, has its own benefits aside from, you know, I don't want to say they're totally equivalent, but it was pointed out to me by someone else that actually, you know, in policy cost terms, that's not so bad.
Yeah. This is maybe a future perfect podcast. Sometime we get the freaky utilitarians in and think about what we should be doing with this. I do think that's a good, you know, sense of scale, right? Also, I mean, if you think about just simply like the out-of-pocket costs to a parent of a child's life.
$260,000, according to the most recent USDA estimate.
Right. So the idea that the lower bound would be around $100,000 is
pretty
not
reasonable.
That, right. It's... Yeah. Kids are expensive, so programs to generate kids are also expensive.
Now, I should note that there are very real success stories. Canada, actually, specifically Quebec, had a baby bonus that basically it was paid when the child was born in a lump sum. Australia did a similar thing, and both of these programs had pretty clearly demonstrated effects and were comparatively cost effective. Hmm. So, a large lump sum payment right after birth is much more cost effective than a child tax credit paid over 17 years. Now, this tends to rub progressives the wrong way. Uh-huh. They say, this is weird. We're just paying, what are we doing? We're just dropping $10,000 on having a baby. But there's a neat way that you can do this. You can say, well, hold on. We're going to extend FMLA, unpaid leave, by another 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And we're going to give you a $10,000 leave compensation bonus when the child is born.
Okay.
So it's paid family leave. It's also a baby bonus.
It is interesting. I mean, there is like people are susceptible to different kinds of framing effects, shall we say, about some of these things where I think right now progressives are very interested in paid family leave. Mm-hmm.
And it's a baby bonus. It's right. A lot of money delivered in the first few months of a child's life.
And I mean, when you think about the upfront payment versus the stream of benefits, right? It makes sense, not just in, well, for one thing, people sort of discount hyperbolically, but also having a child myself, it's when they are new, there is both a lot of upfront costs associated with
time cost, money cost.
And it's a big drag on your ability to earn mm-hmm. money, right?
Once, I mean, the mommy penalty literature on what happens to women's wages after work is very clear on this.
Right.
That it really makes sense to kind of say, okay, we're going to really dump a lot of money right there.
And then the other thing is that I don't know, but it's like the biological cycle of when it's good to have kids and the economic cycle of where your earnings go.
They don't always match.
Don't line up that well.
There are many people who would say, I'd love to have a kid right now. You know, I'm in years where it's easy to do so, but I can't afford it. And then when they can afford it, it's late and it's a lot more expensive. There's more reproductive technology involved. And there's a place where a lot of American families experience a disappointment that I think is worth considering from a policy angle.
And a lot, just normal people of child-having age are going to be earning more money 10 years after their first kid is born, right? They're going to both because of like mom penalty stuff, but also dads, even people who don't take any time out of the workforce, the natural development of your career is that when you're in your late 30s,
your
early 40s, you're going to be doing better. So, you know, that's a case for doing it up front.
Sure.
And so what have we seen from, you wrote a piece about Hungary, which has one of these, no, but you know, I mean, well, people have bad things to say about Orbán, but—
I have bad things to say about Orbán.
But in theory, this is supposed to be like the new, you know,
post-liberal
nationalism. So what did they come up with there?
Okay. So Hungary has been— very prominent in the American right for their family benefits. Anytime they do a new family benefit, it's on Tucker Carlson, right? It's in all the conservative magazines. And a while back, I sort of said, wow, this is really interesting. But then I noticed their fertility rate wasn't rising. In fact, it's been falling in recent years. Hmm. So, man, this is really a problem. The academic literature says this shouldn't be happening. Mm-hmm. So what's going on? Well, it turns out what they're really doing is they've cut a lot of family programs. And they are taking that money and they are redirecting it to a narrow subset of families in the form of subsidized loans for specific consumption decisions. So if you want to buy a big van, There's a subsidized loan for it. And, you know, it won't surprise you to learn that there's a large van-making company in Hungary. If you would like new housing, now they've changed the rules now, you can use it for some used housing. But at first, it was only new housing, so construction industry, you could get a special loan as long as you had a certain number of kids. And now there's a special loan that you can get for just general consumption when you have a kid. But the way it works is you get the loan for the first kid, and then you must have at least three kids to continue to get the loan subsidy. And if you don't have three kids in a certain amount of time, you got to pay the loan back.
Okay.
Right? So it's like debt peonage for fertility. And what this is really about is that the government is just backstopping a very large consumer credit expansion for Hungarian banks.
Right.
Right? So this is not pronatalism.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't know what this is, but it's not about having babies be born. It's about, you know, specific Hungarian families who are going to have lots of kids getting, you know, very generous credit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess in some ways it's like it's more simplistic, right? Like it's a straightforward approach, right? On the marriage front is you have to just like pay what it costs to not
just
to not have the
penalties.
Penalty. On the basic childbearing front, it's like
just pay some money.
You give some money.
So Latvia has a pretty generous suite of child benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And Latvia is also explicitly pronatal.
Hmm.
And they actually also have right now they have a fairly right-leaning government. So it mystifies me why conservatives haven't looked there, because Latvia just says, look, everybody's going to get these benefits.
Okay.
Now, for your first kid, the benefit is this. For your second kid, it's a little higher. For your third kid, it's a little higher. And so it's kind of at each one, they're like, well, we know it's a hassle to have the extra kid, but really, you know.
So does that work, that increasing marginalism?
Fertility, it does. Yeah. So a lot of research shows that two ways to make your spending, there are three big ways to make pronatal spending more effective. One we already talked about, lump it up front. Big paychecks are highly salient. The second is parity targeting. That if you want the most babies for your buck, which I don't know that you should, I think there's a benefit to even neutral programs that don't discriminate by family type.
Right.
But if you want that, targeting second, third, fourth parity kids tends to be more effective. And the third one is interesting. There was a brand new paper that just came out. Well, the final version just came out. The working paper has been circulating for years. I'm suggesting that if you could explicitly target payments to women, that it's
right.
cheaper. Because of basically household negotiation over who stays home and stuff like that, right? So the argument is that your best program in terms of maximum babies per dollar, so to speak, would be a giant baby bonus paid up front only for third or higher children into a bank account that only females could access. That's probably not a program you can have in a liberal society.
Yeah, I saw that paper about the intra-family bargaining.
It was interesting.
And it was... I didn't really understand what they were saying at the end of the day.
So,
the point for those listening at home was that in effect, in the vast majority of cases, mom winds up bearing more of the time costs of child rearing. So if the mom specifically could receive extra financial support, this would work. But then I don't know of...
How would you do that?
Right.
How do you make sure that only mom? Like, so they did do a calibration where they did a run where basically said, what if you can't designate who gets it? And it makes it a little more expensive. But the point of all this is just that, you can target parity, and that is a little more cost effective. Fundamentally, I don't have an objection to targeting parity. It is a little more cost effective. I think there is something to be said for it. At the same time, you know, I understand that people have objections to non-neutrality in terms of family type.
Right.
And so I don't want to get into arguing whether we should have 10% higher for the second kid if we can agree on every kid getting
right.
this.
Well, it's interesting to me because I feel like a lot of some thinking on this seems based on the opposite assumption, that there's like a declining marginal cost of extra kids because, you know, because kids share toys and get hand-me-down
clothes.
So
there is a declining cost for each additional child, which is why adding that extra nudge is even more effective, right? Hmm. So yeah, they're cheaper. And so if you nudge it a little harder, you get sort of even more bang for your buck.
I see.
Right? So that extra $2,000 stretches even farther for the third child than it did for the first.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? So you get more baby per dollar of subsidy.
So now how about things like childcare or preschool, stuff like that. That's not, you know, these are, I mean, I guess the other way to think about it, right, is like most people don't think of this as like quote unquote pronatalist policy.
Right.
But if we had no public schools,
then yeah,
having children would be prohibitively expensive for everybody.
It'd be very challenging. Yeah. There is research suggesting that greater spending on childcare and public education may increase childbearing. However, it's not a lot of it. It's mostly pretty aggregate level or highly theoretical or not really very experimentally based, because how do you test this? How do you be like, well, we implemented daycare and 6 years later, people had babies.
Sure.
Like, so it's a bit tricky to test. Now, I think on the whole, yeah, if you spend more money on kids' stuff, makes it cheaper to have kids, that probably means more kids. At the same time, there are a lot of countries spending a whole lot of money on kids' stuff and not getting a lot of kids from it.
Hmm.
So for example, there is a lot of research on paid leave. And the research suggests that the paid part of paid leave makes people have more babies.
Mm-hmm.
The leave part of paid leave makes people have less babies.
Huh.
So it ends up about a wash.
So what do you mean the leave part makes people have less babies?
Increased attachment to work reduces future fertility.
I see. Well,
reduces future birth rates. So paid leave means you're more likely to return to work.
I see.
And if you return to work, you're less likely to have a subsequent child. Whereas if you stay out of work, you're more likely to say, well, you know, I already am providing childcare at home. You know, providing it for a second child is not necessarily so much more expensive.
I see. So it's not the leave exactly. It's the guaranteed return.
Sure. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. I think of leave as basically a guaranteed return option.
Sure. Sure.
But, but yeah, it's the guarantee. It's the guarantee of return that, and again, this, I'm in favor of paid leave.
Mm-hmm,
I think it's a good thing. There's a compelling argument about parent-child bonding, about just a public ethic of care that is wrapped up in paid leave. I'm in favor of it, but I don't think we should be making an argument that paid leave is going to change people's childbearing.
Right. So the part of it that would help in that regard is just attaching money.
Yeah, it's the fact that there's money connected
to it. And so then that means that the sort of wage replacement rate in a program design is actually very important.
Yeah, so actually
right?
There was a great study in Germany where they changed the way that paid leave was calculated. So instead of making it capped, they said that it'll be proportional to income.
Mm-hmm.
So they made it kind of regressive, actually, that wealthier people or higher earners got more. And they found this was highly effective, that actually this greatly increased birth rates among women who benefited from the reform, so higher income women, and it reduced fertility rates among women who lost from the reform, so lower income women. Now, I don't know that we should have a regressive payment structure for paid leave, but it proved the point that wage replacement rates matter.
Wait, I mean, the regressive structure, well, I don't know. That seems like a bridge too far for some other reasons. But yeah, this is one reason why it's relevant, right? Because we come in again and again, I think, in this conversation to actually all the time in the weeds to targeting conversations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's if you try to target EITC and other benefits specifically at the neediest families, you create these marriage penalties, right? If you try to target like baby bonuses or some child support payments simply to the families most objectively facing some kind of objective material deprivation, then you leave out a lot of middle-class people who are still – it's not that they're like living in the streets, but they are sensitive to the large financial costs of children.
Absolutely.
And so you have to be – whether you are willing to – dedicate financial resources to families who may not quote unquote need it, right, makes a big difference in terms of family structure.
Absolutely. And this is why I really feel quite strongly that when we talk about these benefits, I say benefits because that's what people comprehend, but I generally try to refer to them as something like a parenting wage, right? That what we're talking about here is not needy families needing child benefits. What we're talking about is the fact that we think that parenting, that raising children is a worthwhile contribution, raising children is a worthwhile contribution to society. It is a form of work. It should be paid.
Right.
That this is actually what this is about. And this helps explain, especially to conservatives who I think have you know, ultimately philosophically fair concerns about cost here, that you know, yes, it costs money, but we're not paying for no work.
Right.
We're paying for work. We're paying for some of the most important work in our society. It's as important as whatever it is that Jeff Bezos does with his time.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, and then from the progressive perspective, right, something a lot of Democrats in Congress have gotten interested in is the idea of a, what do you call it, a universal child benefit,
yep.
Right? And this is discussed in their circles primarily for its impact on child poverty,
mm-hmm.
Right? Which is, I mean, large. You can read the Vox explainers on that. There it raises the question of targeting, because obviously to narrowly reduce child poverty, you don't need to give me a child tax credit.
Right.
But it's still expensive mm-hmm. to everybody to have children, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I understand the focus on child poverty. I think it's important and pressing, and there's a whole ethic of opportunity involved here that relates to child poverty. But I generally think that universal benefits are the way to go. I mean, mm-hmm. yes, they cost money, but they also mean that you don't have the next six generations of opposition party leaders trying to find a way to chip down on it.
Mm-hmm, right.
Right? That they're benefiting from it. And especially where there's a compelling case where a lot of conservatives can be brought on board with this kind of policy, are already on board with this kind of policy, if it is clear that it is not just, you know, a handout for people not working, but that we're giving this to literally anyone who mm-hmm. is shouldering the cost of, you know, having children. This is something that it creates buy-in, not just in a, well, everyone gets it, so everyone has a material interest, but it creates philosophical buy-in.
Well, and then I think the way I would bring poverty into the picture is, you know, we talked about the fact that there's a certain amount of, like, quote-unquote waste in the child payment, because you're paying families for kids they would be having anyway.
Yeah.
But some of that
is going to alleviate objective material deprivation.
Right,
sure.
That currently exists.
Yeah,
I mean, the United States has a much, at least a much higher rate of relative poverty than you see in other countries. And that's because primarily we don't have that kind of monetary support for
sure.
kids. So have you looked at what's the Senate Democrats' bill on this?
I wrote an extensive review of it for the Institute for Family Studies.
We
were reasonably favorable. You know, we had a few technical concerns, a few like basically specific bill language concerns with a couple of the exact phase out calculations, you know, basically some little things. But in principle,
mm-hmm.
My take and the take of every time someone at IFS has written on this subject has been like, in principle, this is a good idea. Let's work it out.
So what are the concerns?
So they undid the change in phase out that was put in the new child tax credit. They
okay.
re-lowered it to save on cost. They also, I'm trying to remember exactly, the new child tax credit, you need a social security number for.
Okay.
They undid that for their proposed child benefit.
Right.
So it's this like buried argument about immigration.
Right.
I mean, if you would like to get to 60 votes, you will be requiring social security numbers.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So it just depends on whether you really want to do this or not. But there were a few others, but most of the piece that I wrote on it was actually speaking to conservatives mm-hmm. about why this really was not, this is not a threat. This is actually something we can get on board with. And then there's also the funding question.
Sure.
How do we pay for it? I have all sorts of thoughts about that, but that's not inherent to the bill itself.
Sure. Okay, so let's take a break, and then let's talk about airy ideological concerns.
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core, to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to Hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Okay, so in real world Congress, like Pay-4 is very important, very contentious. Everybody has their taxes they don't want raised, and the ones that they do. But in the realm of ideas, there was like a Washington Post article recently, which I think made the argument that essentially like all concern about Americans having too few children is a sublimated form of white nationalism, mm-hmm. Which I think is worth talking about.
I think
about,
it's worth taking very seriously.
Because, I mean, we have discussed, you know, in previous episodes of the podcast, there is a sort of, like, great replacement.
Mm-hmm. Eugenic pronatalism is a very real, it exists. Mm-hmm. Acting like it doesn't would be ridiculous.
As does eugenic, I mean, I guess the... I would temper the analysis there that, like, eugenic antinatalism has also been a big theme
yes,
in American life.
It has.
And part of this is that the United States is not Europe, right? And so the United States has always been a racially diverse
yeah.
country. And so these concerns about whose babies, mm-hmm. like, have been with us for a long time on, yep. on all sides of the of yep. the argument. But so are you a white nationalist? Can I clear
no,
the air?
No, I am not.
Okay.
And just
so you disavow.
In whatever terms you prefer. But more importantly, I think when we talk about raising the birth rate, oftentimes people say, well, this is just Steve King's, you know, other people's baby white nationalism. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, hold on. In any plausible world, the only way to raise birth rates in America is to do it with more Hispanic, Asian, Black, Native American babies. In fact, the biggest decline in fertility in recent years has been among Hispanics and Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say I'm worried about falling fertility, I mean I'm worried that not enough Hispanic and Native American and African American babies are being born. And actually demographically, when you sort of sit down and do the math on population change, lower fertility rates mm-hmm. push farther out the date at which we become a non-Hispanic white minority country.
Right. So if you sort of check your tables, Pew has a good thing where mm-hmm. they do the median age of different ethnic sure. groups in the United States, right? And so the median white person is like mid-40s.
Right. They're basically past reproductive, out of most of their reproductive life.
At this point, right. And African Americans, even Asians are fairly old, but still younger yeah, than yeah. white people. African Americans considerably younger yeah. and Latinos considerably younger.
So high fertility rates on net tend to racially diversify the
right,
country,
right.
whereas
so the,
low fertility is sort of an ossification of current racial mixes.
Right. And so in a practical sense, I think the politics, like the political problem is almost the opposite direction.
Right.
That, you know, a question always is, you know, are these our kids that we are supporting? Are these our families that we are supporting? And in particular, there's been a, you know, I think a racialized mm-hmm. Concern about giving financial support to low-income families because many of those families are not white, right? I mean, if you want to understand the history of the development of the American welfare state, it's not that we've been pushing family support payments to sort of keep the white race up. It's very much the opposite.
Right. I mean, I think there is a lot of I'm not as well read in, but I believe there's a lot of political science research suggesting that racial resentment and racial resentment paired with racial diversity is a pretty good predictor, to the point of it very well may be causal at lower state level support for public insurance and other forms of social welfare. This is fairly clearly what it's usually been in America. But that's it is possible that positive expansion of benefits could be some kind of front for white supremacy. Like, I don't want to act like that's categorically impossible.
Sure, sure.
But like, in practice, if most of the people receiving the benefit they're advocating for are not white, and if the effect of implementing the benefit is to make the country on net more diverse,
right,
and if doing so is about helping individuals achieve clearly stated individual goals, as is the case with desired fertility, and if it is also in fact the case that non-white individuals actually express higher fertility ideals, which is also the case, then like what are we talking about here?
Sure.
Like where's the white supremacy?
Right.
Now, if we were saying like, well, we're only going to give benefits to white people,
this would be
white supremacy. Or even you could do this at backdoor, right? You could be like, we're only going to give benefits to married families of $50,000 in income or higher.
Sure, it's sure.
Like, okay, we see you.
Yes, yes.
But like, that's not where the conversation is right now. I mean, the most radical you get on that front on the right now in terms of, you know, any actual real thing is like, should the phase in for the child tax credit be at like $2,000 or $6,000? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, the number of people impacted by this is really small. And in this, it's in some sense, it's a debate over an accounting reality as much as anything else.
Right. And then, so then the flip side of this is that, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people on the left are like, they're watching The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, and they are maybe moving to the big city and getting crap from their aunt about when are they having kids? And
yep.
I mean, you and I come from different places and might be having a different discussion in a world where people were telling General Social Survey, like, I only want to have one.
So I encountered this problem, actually. So I live in Hong Kong, and I wrote an article for South China Morning Post about fertility policy in Hong Kong. And the average woman in Hong Kong only wants to have about 1.5 or 1.6 kids. And they end up having a little bit below that. But the point is, it's very low desired fertility.
Right.
So I wrote, I'm on record on this, in a context where desired fertility is low, there's a serious question about not only it won't be effective to throw money at the problem, that's not going to work in terms of raising fertility, but second of all, it's not clear that it's ethical.
Right.
That if you're trying to get people, like trying to force people to have babies that they don't want to have, you need a pretty compelling reason. I would say you need more than a rational basis test.
And is this basically like America's more religious than Hong Kong? Is that what that comes down to?
No, so actually desired fertility is generally above 2 throughout most of Europe.
Okay.
Low fertility desires below fertility desires below 2 are extremely rare. The only documented cases that I've been able to find and I've looked are mainland China and Hong Kong today. Some surveys of Taiwan, but others disagree, and they're barely below 2. And then post-Soviet states during the 90s.
Okay, so...
Oh, sorry, also Malta.
Malta.
But that could be small sample size, but...
Don't know a lot about Malta, I'm gonna have to admit.
It's often a society... It has generally indicated some kind of state... some form of issue with state stability or repression.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, that makes some sense. So then I'm like a housing guy, right? And this just also seems like an obvious, I would not say the reason to rethink like American housing policy, but it definitely seems like a relevant consideration, right? That if you I don't know, like kids take up space. People want bigger houses when they have kids. And when your community doesn't allow that, then some of that is where people move away, but some of it is where people really like it, the city they live in.
So, I mean, there's a lot of research showing that, that, first of all, American families are experiencing housing stress.
Right.
Over the last 20 years, the share of income that American families, USDA tracks spending on children in the housing subcategory has risen something like 37%, but prices of housing have risen about 70% over that same window, which suggests that, in fact, there's a housing crunch for families.
Yeah,
they're living in smaller spaces.
When Jenny Schutz was on the podcast, that housing distress is very concentrated among families with children, which it makes sense. Like they need more.
It's very real, and the research suggests that when there are sharp increases in housing costs, fertility falls. And there's also research showing that when land use regulations are tightened, fertility falls. Mm-hmm. There are explicit zoning codes that zone out families that through minimum occupancy rules or sometimes literally age rules about who can live in a neighborhood, which are done to ensure like aging with dignity communities. Right. And I'm thinking, so anti-family. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are all kinds of these sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit rules. DC's rule requiring extra degrees and certification for childcare.
Right.
Sometimes it's less – DC was relatively subtle in what they were getting at. Some cities are rather less subtle and they just deny zoning permits to daycares.
Right. And so, another zoning topic that is near and dear to my heart is, if you talk to developers, right, when you limit the number of floors, basically, that they can build in their new apartment, condo, whatever, it becomes very, very, very revenue maximizing to dedicate that square footage to junior one bedroom and studio units, right? Because there's like a declining marginal price of square footage, right?
Yep.
But if you tap out the sort of market's ability to absorb those units, because like lots of people don't want to live. There's only so many people who want to live in a studio apartment, right? At a certain point, you force them to do the inefficient thing and build multi-bedroom dwellings. But if you can only build a little bit, it all goes into houses for single people, which, even though I have never heard a policymaker explicitly say, I don't want anybody with children moving to my city, it is from a property tax standpoint.
It happens in neighborhood
efficient.
Meetings all the time.
Right.
It's actually quite common in neighborhood meetings. Sometimes you get this strange thing where someone will stand up and say, well, this will affect the neighborhood in this way. And it's hard to tell whether they're talking about the race of the people coming in or the age.
Right.
And you think neither one of those is okay. I think you do hear it explicitly sometimes, but usually it is implicit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's actually unintentional.
Right.
We want to make sure that there's a certain amount of parking available, so that families can find a place to park.
Right.
I mean, okay. Nice thought. But they needed housing more.
Right. So, well, and you also hear, this has been a thing in Montgomery County in the suburbs here where they say, well, if we build this new stuff, the schools are going to be overcrowded.
Yep. School overcrowding.
It's objectively true. If there were more children, they would take up more space in school. But it's not like beyond human comprehension that you would build extra schools.
It turns out it is possible to build schools.
And traditionally, right, it's not like when the pilgrims came here, they just found all these school buildings every place. They were all overcrowded once upon a time, right? And that's sort of how they got here. I guess another thing I wonder about sometimes is like parenting, like ideology, right? Like it seems like modern day parents like do more, but that then makes it harder to have children.
So there is some research suggesting that parents spend more time parenting than in the past. It comes out of time use data. But the change is really, really, really sharp in, I believe it's the late 90s. It goes from like flat around a few hours a day per kid to like six or something. And so my inclination is to think this is actually a data problem, not a real thing. But we do see some more clear and objective measures. For example, the share of children that are breastfed is much higher now than in the past. Now, there's a lot of, you know, public health literature about this, whatever, but we should all recognize that this is a time commitment, right?
Yeah.
This takes more time than formula. There are other things, you know, you can look at a number of private lessons being hired out. You can look at any number of these things to see that intensive parenting is more of a norm now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I mean, it's a good thing. It's good for people to spend time with their kids. That's great. I love it that people will invest in their children. At the same time, it creates a norm.
Right.
And norms, people tend to respond to the superstructure for a life script.
Right.
If everyone else is establishing the norm that you do this, then you do this.
Right. People want to be good parents.
Exactly.
Whatever that's understood
right.
to mean.
They want to be perceived as good parents.
Right.
They want to be good parents, and they also want to be seen as good parents. And so this does definitely increase the time, psychological, and sometimes money cost of parenting. I mean, a simple one is food,
uh-huh.
right? That you shouldn't give your child Pepsi. You should go and buy them a fruit juice that has the exact same amount of sugar in it, but that's, you know, it's fine to give the juice pouch. That's not
You need to get to more
class.
Advanced yuppie parenting circles. There's nothing fine about giving kids juice.
Are we past juice now?
You just got to make them drink water.
Oh, okay. See, well, is cheaper. That's great. but you get this where it's like you have to like be doing this treadmill of like each new round of like special food and the thing your kid should be eating and the thing they should be drinking. It's like child mortality has risen in recent years. It hasn't fallen. So whatever these new trends are, I don't know that I really think they're making a huge difference.
Hmm. No, I mean, I think of actually like screen time moral panic as like yep. a big example of this, right? Because
sure.
obviously the simplest way to get children of not all ages, but there's a range of ages in which like if you need a kid to do something that is safe for a little bit of time while somebody gets something done, like let them watch Stinky and Dirty is highly effective, right? And if that becomes stigmatized, then the cost, whether explicit monetary cost of childcare or just the implicit time cost of dealing with them in a more active way gets really, really high. And, you know, when the Academy of Pediatrics comes out with like recommendations about this, I don't think I mean, it's both that yeah. the research base on the screen time is a little dodgy, but more to the point, like they're not thinking like
yeah.
in equilibrium about the impact yeah. on society, these
so
recommendations.
Screen time is one where I really, really wish that we had, that we had better data.
Right.
Because there's a lot that we don't know. Now, on the one hand, I'm inclined to say that, you know, elites should preach what they practice,
mm-hmm.
that most well-educated families recognize that when their kid is on the TV all day or on the cell phone all day or whatever, that it doesn't actually achieve their parenting goals.
Right.
And it makes sense for us to then say to other people like, hey, like maybe this is a norm worth emulating. At the same time, I think you're right that when we create these expectations that if you don't do this, you're a bad parent. This is a failure of parenting, that you're not really parenting if your kid watches TV. People have time stresses. People mm-hmm. have other things in their life. People have, they have other needs. So I think that there is a balance between saying, you know, okay, this might actually have some child welfare effect that maybe we want to care about. But then at the other side saying, you know, whatever we're doing is not reducing child mortality. So
right.
it's not having that much of a child.
All right. So so before this just turns into a Weeds Parenting Hour, I really need different guests for that anyway. So we're going to I want to let you go. But before that happens, is there anything else, you know, I should ask you want to talk about here? What do the Weedsers need to know about like baby policy?
I mean, I think you got good questions. I would just reiterate the idea that wanting there to be more humans in America is somehow a white supremacist conspiracy is nonsense.
There you go.
It just is.
Okay, nonsense. Okay, so thank you, Lyman Stone, Institute for Family Studies, American Enterprise Institute. Thanks to our sponsors, and thanks as always to our producer, Jeffrey Geld, and the Weeds will return on Tuesday.